Philip of Macedonia, the Battle of Chaeronea, Part 2. Now the Allies seem to have chosen a position where their flanks were protected by streams and broken terrain in the valley sides. This would have made it hard for Philip to outflank them. Given Theban fondness for deploying unusually deep phalanxes, this position may have been relatively narrow for an army of this size. In some contingents, formed in significantly more depth than the standard eight ranks. Diodorus says that the Thebans were on the one flank and the Athenians on the other, but he doesn't specify which. Just as vaguely, he has Alexander on one flank and Philip on the other. The Lion Monument is right where most scholars position the Allied line, and right was traditionally the place of honor, so appropriate in a Theban-commanded army. While Athenian fugitives escaped over the Cirrhata Pass, which is on the left side of the valley. Therefore, a reasonable case can be made that the Thebans were on the right and the Athenians on the left. No mention is made of either side's cavalry during the battle. Often repeated descriptions of Alexander charging at the head of his companion cavalry are wholly simply conjectural. The most common position for cavalry was on the wings. It is possible that they were held back. Alexander is credited with breaking the sacred band, thus allowing the above scholars to put him on the Macedonian left. The usual place the sacred band would be on the extreme right of the Theban line, so that Philip was stationed on the right since he seems to have faced the Athenians. Two stratagems are attributed to the king in the battle. In one, he is supposed to have feigned a withdrawal, drawing the inexperienced Athenians forward, just as Onomarchus had lured Philip's men in 353 BCE. Stratocles, an Athenian general, is supposed to have urged those around him to chase the enemy back to Macedon. Pushing forward, the Athenians gave up their strong position, while the Macedonian phalanx pulled back in good order until it was standing on higher ground. Having declared that the Athenians didn't know how to win a victory, Philip counterattacked and drove the enemy back. If this occurred at all, then like William the Conqueror at Hastings, he may have made a virtue out of what was initially a genuine retreat, realizing that the enemy was being lured out of position and losing their formation in the process. Another story has Philip deliberately drawing the battle out, believing that his well-trained men could endure longer than the inexperienced Athenians. In general, this was no doubt true, for Demosthenes was wont to complain that Athens had relied far more on mercenaries than citizen hoplites for some time. Although highly motivated, many of the citizen soldiers were past their prime and unlikely to have been especially fit, while few had experience of fighting in a phalanx. Diodorus also has the armies deploying at dawn and the fight raging for a long time, with the fortunes swaying back and forth. No sources hints that the Allies broke quickly, so a prolonged fight seems likely. A high proportion of Philip's infantry were armed with sarissas, although we cannot say how many of his 30,000 foot soldiers were light soldiers or hoplites provided by his allies. While it looks as if some of the elite infantry of the Macedonian army, known in Alexander's time as hypaspis, usually wielded spears rather than pikes. The sarissa had a much longer reach than a hoplite spear, was unlikely to penetrate a hoplite shield, at least with sufficient force to wound the man carrying it, but when wielded well, it could strike at the face and the neck. By this period, the majority of hoplites wore open-faced helmets rather than the enclosed Corinthian type usually associated with them. Macedonian pikemen could reach their hoplite opponents, but unless they could break or push aside several sarissa heads in succession, it's hard to see how the allied hoplites could harm their enemies. Yet prolonged fighting and significant number of Macedonian dead attested by the burial mound, to which must be added a far greater number of wounded, judging from other battles, makes it clear that they did. A spear could be thrown, and it is a mistake to assume that some hoplites did not carry additional spears or javelins in some circumstances. Pikemen had smaller shields and less chance of shifting them to catch a missile, but were offered a degree of protection from the shafts of the sarissas carried by the men in the ranks behind them. Perhaps there are some archers amongst the phalanx or close behind it, for the practice was certainly common in earlier centuries, and would have made sense in the context of Chaeronea. In the years that followed, it is known the Athenian youths went through a period of training in their late teens, including archery, and the practice may have been established earlier. So even among the hoplite class, there were men with some basic familiarity with bows. Overall, the impression is of a slogging battle with losses on both sides, all suggesting local retreats and lulls as men gathered their breath. Alexander has said they've been the first to break the enemy line, although this may be more than an enviable praise for the 18-year-old prince who would 2 years later become king. Plutarch says that he broke the ranks of the sacred band, and perhaps he did. It was not simply too tempting for later authors to resist connecting the young hero with the defeat of the famous elite unit. The allied line broke up and eventually collapsed, leaving 1,000 Athenians dead and some 2,000 prisoners. The Theban losses were on a similar scale. Demosthenes was one of the fugitives who fled over the Carrata Pass. No figures are given for Macedonian casualties, and the losing side tended to suffer far more heavily than the victors, as men were cut down in the initial stages of flight. That does not seem to have been a prolonged pursuit of the sort Philip employed against tribal enemies, whether unwilling to retreat, surrounded, and unable to do so, or choosing to cover the flight of the others by deliberate sacrifice. The 255 corpses buried under the Lion Monument are often assumed to be from this unit. The total is certainly close enough and would have represented catastrophic casualties sufficient to justify talk of annihilation, even if this was not literally true. Monuments were not normally set up by the losers, so something needs to explain why the Thebans did this. The commemoration of the famous heroes, perhaps decades later, when symbols of past glory were of use in contemporary politics, makes sense. Yet no ancient sources associates the Lion Monument with the Sacred Band, and it is possible that it covers a larger graveyard, for only some of the ground has actually been excavated. The surviving remains testify to the brutal realities of combat with edged weapons. One man had most of his face sliced off by a sword cut. Philip had won the biggest battle, the largest battle of his career, but there are conflicting traditions about his conduct in the aftermath of the battle. Justin has the king behaving with greater restraint and refusing to exult at his success, while Plutarch says that he wept at the sight of the sacred band lying dead almost in formation. Yet Diodorus reports an alternative where Philip held a wine-fueled celebration before processing around in the company of similar drunken friends, dancing and mocking prisoners and the enemy dead alike. Demedes, a captured general, sobered him by saying that he ought to be acting like Agamemnon, the leaders of the Greek army at Trojan War, not Thersites, the ugliest, least heroic warrior in the Iliad. Winning the battle was a great achievement, but Philip knew that the key was making a permanent peace. He needed to secure his position and ensure that there were no more serious challenges from the city-states, and this required a balance between threats and persuasion. History showed that the Greek communities resented anything they saw as humiliation, nursing the grudge until they felt that they had even the slightest chance of avenging themselves. They also expected victors to show little or no restraint, exploit their power to inflict maximum injury on the defeated. Philip had smashed the army led by Thebes in Athens, and they and their allies fearfully awaited the next move. If Philip punished them severely, then this would entrench their hatred and lay up problems for the future. While if he destroyed or severely crippled them, he could not be sure that the new balance of power to emerge in southern Greece would favor him. The instinctive independence of the Greeks that made it so hard for them to come together in a cause also made it harder for them to deal with them, for how each city is treated had an impact on how others were likely to behave in the future. Even for a man who took such pride in his diplomatic achievements, this was a real challenge for Philip. Now, the sources for this: The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond. In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.